Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm Diane Wachowski from the English department, and tell me if you can hear me. Is this going to, is this okay, this mic?
My microphone is wireless.
Linda Nemec Foster is an interesting American poet because she doesn't fit any of the stereotypes. She doesn't write out of the romantic cult of personality that creates a Lady Lazarus like Sylvia Plath, living and dying for love and poetry. Nor does she write out of the Dionysian orgiastic excitement of the Whitman tradition, exulting about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Linda Nemec Foster is also not one of those American magicians of pop culture with New Yorker sophistication and Museum of Modern Art savvy and jazzy language like Frank O'Hara or Ann Waldman. Neither is she a pastoralist of Oregon or Kansas pure landscapes like William Stafford, nor an American city voice like James Wright or Bill Merwin. She's not a flamboyant feminist like Adrienne Rich or a fashion-conscious philosopher like Jory Graham. American poets are supposed to be flashy, big screen epics in technicolor or cowboy romantics. We are supposed to be Whitman-esque with big beards and audacious voices. But the poet I'm going to introduce tonight breaks all of those stereotypes. In fact, in looking for the genius of Linda Nemec Foster's American voice as I studied her work this month, what I found was a most interesting mythic trait: the ability to be invisible. The cap of invisibility was one of those three magic gifts the Hyperboreans gave to Perseus to help him slay the Medusa with Hermes' sword and Athena's bronze shield. Her shield like a mirror so that he wouldn't have to look into the Gorgon's eyes, and the sword to cut off her head. But first, he needed the cap of darkness, which would allow him to come up to her, invisible, and thus be able to accomplish his heroic task. Linda Nemec Foster has also been gifted with a cap of invisibility. She uses it to sneak up on the reader and achieve an up-close scrutiny of the world. She is able to put on the magic cap of darkness that allows an artist to be everywhere and to see everything up close, intimately, without the interference of personality, aggression, cultural screens, or expectations of landscape. Often, artists and intellectuals with this gift become historians or scientists or biographers. They can look closely and see so much without the interference of ego and expectation. What a gift, therefore, if we find a poet able to manage this gaze. For an American poet to shed these extravagant wrappings of romantic personality or the baggage of landscape and culture, for her to move to a kind of pure voice of reason is, as I said, quite remarkable, quite unusual. For example, one of Linda Nemec Foster's most skillful poems, Heat Lightning, gives us a meditation on life that comes through her mother's image of lightning being God's flashbulbs going off. While this is a wonderful metaphor and an insightful way to look at the world, this modest poet does not even pretend it is her own original idea. She attributes it to her mother. Yet she offers us a vivid use of this original idea through the clear lens of her own language, observed from what another person's ideas were. And mother would whisper, "Things that can't touch you can't hurt you." Such a wholesome lie. I wanted to believe it, and almost did. The result of this technique is to embrace the originality of a common American woman, Foster's mother, rather than to make a personal claim for herself, the poet. This democratic vision, which does not feature the poet's uniqueness, but celebrates someone else's, is an oddly powerful gesture. Perhaps this is typical of a new kind of poetry being written in this country, one that embraces middle-class values of community and respect over and above those of personality, ego, and romantic individuality. In another equally fine poem called My Son Expounds on His Theory of Creation, Linda Nemec Foster repeats this gesture by telling about the very imaginative and original ideas her son has about the universe. Not Foster's original ideas, but her son's. In this case, these ideas are a sweetly original vision, reminiscent of the idea of reincarnation presented in Maxine Kuhman's wonderful poem, The Retrieval System, that when animals die, they become angels, in particular, the guardian angels of people. Again, the clear lens of the poet's eye is used to present this vision, not only without claiming the original idea for her own, but emphasizing in the title that the original idea does not come from the brilliant mind of the poet, but from her son. Yet, as in Heat Lightning, the poet transforms this wonderful idea into a complex and interesting meditation on the world. It becomes her son's gentle way of telling her that even when he grows up and goes away, he will always be taken care of as she has taken care of him. My guardian angel will be with me always, as real as he was when he walked among us, Sam, our Siamese cat, protecting my every move. His blue eyes will be calm and omniscient like that one day you held him in your lap and he felt the baby kick inside you, the complete and utter improbability, the shock of new life. This clear observational voice is not a decorative one. It is spare and simple, though not without the finesse of image. Her poetry is lucid and written with care and dexterity. In another strong poem, Jesse James at the Osceola Inn, Reed City, Michigan, 1884, Linda Nemec Foster meditates on the way we reinvent our lives through myth and story, not romanticized, but more clearly observed even in the context of storytelling. These clear observations always include some rational means for accepting death and the other unacceptable things in our lives. Her revelation in this particular poem is that perhaps death is the truth and life the lie. I turn to Linda Nemec Foster's poems to discover a non-chaotic world, one ordered by clear and close perception of a selfless observer. Linda Nemec Foster lives in Grand Rapids with her physician husband and her children. She is the author of 3 chapbooks and 1 full-length collection of poems, Living in the Fire Nest, published in 1996 by Ridgeway Press. When I asked her about her work, she wrote, "I love this tension between the world that we think we know and the inner life of that world that only poetry and other creative arts can imagine." She also said that her newer work is intimately informed by being the granddaughter of Polish immigrants and raised in an ethnic neighborhood in inner city Cleveland. She added, "Several years ago, I visited Poland for the first time and saw the villages where my grandparents were born. What an experience that was, charting the map of my personal history, seeing the landscape that nurtured the family, finally visiting relatives that I have been corresponding with for over 30 years. It really was a touchstone for me and my work." However, even though Linda Nemec Foster feels free to use autobiography to write her poems, the poems themselves are seldom documents of personality or biography. Her use of personal material is derivative, not direct. Even before her visit to Poland, she was writing some poems using her heritage as source material. She had written a series of poems using the Russian Slavic fairy tale image of the witch, Baba Yaga, who lives in the forest in a hut mounted on chicken legs. However, she was using this material out of her personal sense of connection to it, not to impose a personal connection onto it or in the poems. One of these poems is among her best. It is "The Peasant Woman Tells How Baba Yaga Took Her Grandmother," a mythic interpretation of Baba Yaga as a death figure. "Grandmother opened the door, let you in. She fed you beet soup and dark bread. You waited for the sign to appear, the beautiful black flower growing out of her own mouth." And the poem ends with the poet's acceptance of death in this traditional form. "I remember you gave her new shoes for the funeral and took a strand of her hair to sew her lips tight, stitching it back and forth until her silence was complete." In fact, many of the poems in Foster's body of work present a calm acceptance of death, enlightened by that sense she mentioned to me in her letter, the inner life of the world. Perhaps the very clarity with which this poet views the world allows her to be fearless and impersonal, imbuing the poems with this wonderful Apollonian gift of rationality. I as someone who is too personal in her approach to life often, and perhaps consequently very afraid of death, I often find the cool, dispassionate poems of Linda Nemec Foster offering reassurance and comfort to me. She is a poet of great meditative calm and resource. Linda Nemec Foster.
Thank you so much, Diana. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here in this whirlwind March madness of basketball fever. But what I'm going to do is go straight to the chase and read you, I'm going to read you a poem based on a fan letter I got. And I don't think we poets get very many fan letters. Certainly not like Mateen Cleaves. I mean, not me. But this was a bona fide fan letter from Germany, of all places. And this is so embarrassing. I can't even remember the man's name. But he somehow got a hold of my poetry, read it, and wrote me several times about it. And the first time, though, was the best. And it wasn't necessarily what he said, but it was what he wrote the note on. He sent me a postcard, and it was a very unusual picture. And anyway, this first poem I'm going to read is entitled Postcard, and it's about this fan letter. Oh, he's a magician, by the way. That was another thing. Not only was he German, he was a magician. Postcard. A magician from Germany sends me a postcard. In halting English, my language foreign and untenable to one who's mastered the silent sleight of hand, he writes about my poems. They remind him of a tightrope dancer, not walker, a tightrope dancer balancing between two myths of understanding, the light and the dark. Such praise from a stranger. And so this postcard, a picture of a tiny woman on top of a 19th century automatic clock. She holds a balancing pole, peeks out of a tree whenever the hour is struck, and attempts the tightrope. She looks like Snow White or Our Lady of Guadalupe, except for the men at her feet, a tiny quartet playing a melody I cannot hear, lute, tambourine, trumpet, snake rattle. All of them dolled up in crimson and gold leaf, waiting for her to perform her stunt, waiting for everything and nothing like purveyors of eternity usually do. But in the picture, she's frozen. It's 4 o'clock and the men just want it to be over, this balancing act, until the next hour announces itself. Of course, nothing happens, except for the wild tree behind her offering a splay of brown leaves, the huge trunk embracing her like a gaping wound as if it were a grotto at Lourdes or Fatima, and she some miraculous vision balancing between who knows what. The magician says he knows, but he won't tell me, or maybe he can't, given the space limitations of a postcard and the risk of communicating mere words to an absolute stranger. And I think of him on the other side of the world, making magenta scarves disappear at whim and white birds flutter from empty hats, holding my poems in his pale foreign hands until they become the thin air of dusk. Diane mentioned a subject matter that has become very dear to me right now. I think the older I get, the more I love my past. You know, the more I love where I've come from and where my family has come from. I didn't think much of this when I was younger. As a matter of fact, I thought of anything but that. But the more I live, the more the spirit of my grandparents mean, you know, so much to me. I am a second-generation Polish-American immigrant, or I should say granddaughter of immigrants. All four of my grandparents came from southern Poland, and these next two pieces are about them. The first one is about my grandmother, and she was some character, let me tell you. There's nothing that I need to tell you about except some place names, some geographical names in that comes at the end of the poem. It's a prose poem, by the way, and it's from a sequence of prose poems that culminate the end of my book, Living in the Fire Nest, and the prose poems are entitled A History of the Body. And they are metaphoric histories of various body parts. And this one about my grandmother is called History of the Toenails. And the last, those things I told you about earlier on, the geographical places in the poem. Vestula is a main river in Poland. It flows from the Tatra Mountains north to the Baltic Sea. Zakopane is a small mountain village in the Tatra Mountains. And Jasna Góra is a tiny town in southwestern Poland where the shrine of the icon of the Black Madonna is kept. All right, History of the Toenails. A quiet, shy character, a male poet in an American short story, insists that toenails grow wild and uncontrollable in East Europe. There, they do not need conscious thought to thrive and flourish. They do it in spite of themselves, without thinking. He feels this part of the world is the only place where history really does matter and, in effect, allows the toenail to be nothing more, nothing less than a toenail. In Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania, old women sift through oppression in tight shoes, binding stockings, and never bother to cut their toenails. They know it is the one part of themselves that is forever replenishing. A prime example, my grandmother from Krakow. Wild and uncontrollable at 86, she cursed her Cleveland-born sons and decided to live in the attic. Finally, she ran away from home in late January with no shoes, her bare feet clicking on the ice, the sound of hard blue toenails, long and curved over the edge of the toes like naturally fitted tap shoes. And the last image she left me was of her dancing out a little secret code spelling Vestula, Zakopane, Tatra, Jasna Góra. Take off your shoes and learn it, she said. I want you to know that I want this to be an interactive poetry reading, just like the web, interactive. If you have any questions, if you don't get something, if you don't like something, if you really like something, you know, raise your hand and let me know. So, you know, there isn't going to be me and then you with your questions. There's going to be, you know, both of us. So the next piece is another a body part, a prose poem called History of the Hand, about my grandfather, married to the toenail lady, Frank. And I'll have more stories about them. When I went to Poland, I found out, I found out some real good gossip about them. But anyway, this is History of the Hand for Frank Niemiec. History of the ditch digger, stonemason, countless men in factories on the line, history of abundance of miracles, because it is by our hands that we become who we are. Marry a man for his hands, my father said, probably remembering his own father and the mangled right hand that was torn in half by the machine at the woolen mill. But what did the old man know about machines? He was a foreigner who couldn't speak the language, a peasant farmer born in Poland when it wasn't even called Poland. His hands knew only two things, black earth and how to coax the miracle of green from it. Each spring, he would perform the miracle in his small American garden. His left hand did the mundane chore of clearing the winter's debris, breaking the ground with hoe and shovel and pickaxe. His right hand, that terrible, wondrous hand, performed the ultimate magic, placed each seed in its proper spot, made sure it grew into a cabbage or pepper or summer squash. I remember how carefully he would wash that hand after the day's work, pat it dry, place it almost casually on my shoulder, luminous, enchanted. I want to fast forward a bit to my parents. And I want to read one of the poems that Diane mentioned, Heat Lightning. Heat Lightning for Therese Becker. The jagged lines of bluish gray were nothing but God taking pictures at night. Just his flashbulbs going off, Mother said. In other words, harmless, temporary, like everything that could ever fade from your life. No thunder came with this lightning. It was always silent and horizontal, never touching the ground, only mutely racing across the sky. A futile attempt to reach a destination that wasn't there, like a hapless runner racing toward the gate of heaven. And Mother would whisper, things that can't touch you, can't hurt you. Such a wholesome lie. I wanted to believe it and almost did. Letting the words lull me into a dream where sparrows had no wings, fathers had no arms, the petals of dahlias closed like tight shutters, and the black sky seemed torn into a million shreds. Each shred tiny and lost, a discarded negative, unable to imagine something whole. In the morning when I awoke, it was as if God had vanished along with his camera. No trace of that quiet lightning going nowhere, just the unbroken blue of the sky and the round sun looking relieved, a bit tired, like the face in an old photograph, an aunt long dead whose name no one remembers, whose face looks familiar, but untouchable. Another thing that sometimes comes up in my poems, believe it or not, are movies. Some good, some bad. I write about, Siskel and Ebert, thumbs up, thumbs down, has nothing to do with my love of writing about them. And so I'm going to give you a really bad cinema experience that hopefully is a great poem, and then also a great cinema experience that I hope is another great poem. But anyway, who would ever think that Gina Lola Brigida and Yul Brynner would be in a poem? But here they are. Yul Brynner with a hairpiece. Not ball, too. So this is about the awful, awful 1959 movie Solomon and Sheba. If you haven't seen it, don't worry about it. You don't need to. Trust me. The poem will give you everything. It's another prose poem from the history of the body section. And I have to apologize to any college freshmen that are here tonight, because I mentioned college freshmen at the end of the and specifically female college freshmen, so please, still like me. History of the legs. Forget the platonic preoccupation with imagery of bone, metaphor of heart. In the hard world of the real world, every living poet favors the legs over any other part of the body. This love affair begins at the crease of knee, climaxes in mid-calf, and doesn't end until it reaches the bony island of the ankle. Men's legs, women's legs arouse the same sensual journey, like the Queen of Sheba's celebrated visit to Solomon. And behold, he fell in love with her legs, being the true poet that he was. No matter that they were covered with coarse Arabian hair, no matter that she came to him merely to obtain a secret depilatory recipe, and certainly not to fall in love, regardless of what that awful 1959 movie would have us believe. But who would believe Yul Brynner as Solomon wearing a greasy Hollywood hairpiece? And who would believe Gina Lola Brigida as Sheba with shaved legs and a ruby in her navel, dancing like a college freshman? Only middle-aged poets with eyes glued to the screen, bodies motionless, legs crossed. That's And I love Gina, Lola, Brigida. I mean, if that's not onomatopoeia in a way, what is? And here's, I have two more cinema poems. And these next two are like, you know, well worth your time, cinema. But again, the kind of thing where you don't need to see the movie to get the poem. And this next poem is really about my favorite film of all time, La Dolce Vita, of Fellini's La Dolce Vita. And you'll some people crop up here: Marcello Mastroianni, Anouk Ami, Anita Ekberg, and my husband. Okay, absurdity of the sweet life. In the living room, my television blares. This evening's movie, complete and uncut, is Fellini's classic, La Dolce Vita. I stand in the kitchen, fixing dinner, the usual boiled potatoes, green beans, meatloaf. Getting the beans washed takes precedence over Jesus flying through the skies of Rome, arms lifted. Now, Marcello and Anouk screw in a whore's flooded apartment, and I'm still in the kitchen. I don't even see Anita's big entrance. Is her blonde hair up? Is she wearing dark glasses? I overhear a question from the Italian press. Is it true you take a bath every morning in ice-cold water without any clothes on? Her tremendous breasts, they're all thinking, could heat up anything. The television still blaring when my husband comes home from work. He forgets about dinner, about his hunger, about his anxious day as he sits mesmerized by Anita, her flowing blonde hair, black strapless gown, those breasts. Now she aimlessly wanders the night streets of Rome with Marcello at her heels and a white kitten on her head. She's in love with the kitty, not poor Marcello, and places it on her fair scalp, its tiny tail brushing her forehead. My husband is certain there's going to be a nude shot. As the dinner starts to burn and Anita finds a big fountain to plunge into, a big fountain her big tits can push out of, but nothing happens. The black, wet, strapless gown still clings. The body remains hidden. The dinner is ruined. My husband grumbles, nothing happens. If Jesus could finish that helicopter ride and touch ground just once more, I wouldn't ask him to perform the miraculous, but only the ordinary, to land in front of the stove, finish stirring the beans and potatoes, and not forget to turn off the meatloaf so I could watch La Dolce Vita from beginning to end, not miss a second of some other life's sweetness. And to some newer work, but still on the theme of movies and how they inform the real world. I'm also getting back to immediate family. It's about my mother and my father. And actually, it's about more of my mother and my father than they probably care for you to know, but they're not here, so I'm going to read it. This is, again, about a foreign film, Jean de Florette. At 68, my mother sees her first foreign film. What next? My father laments as she gushes about Jean de Florette as if she were a critic at Cannes. How she admired the diligent hunchback who loved flowers and tried to grow them in the small plot he inherited in Provence. How she hated the old local farmer and his scheming nephew, those creeps whose mindless greed for the hunchback's land helped them devise a cruel plot. How she marveled at the cruelty of the plot. To block and conceal the natural spring that flows into the hunchback's land and then to pray for a drought. How she was aghast that God answered the creeps' prayers. How she pitied the poor hunchback as he was forced to haul water from a distant well night and day, day and night, to save his precious irises and jonquils, lilies and baby's breath. How she wept when he died for him, for his wife, for his little girl, who looked just like my Ellen. All this emotion from my mother pouring onto the kitchen table. What next? My father moans. He's afraid. This is just the beginning. Next week, she'll give up cold cuts and blood sausage, start eating bean sprouts and tofu. She'll begin to lose weight, get svelte by stonewashed denim and gauze dresses. She'll pierce her ears and then get bored with Cleveland. She'll want to travel to someplace exotic like Fresno. Or worse yet, she'll get bored with him, drop him for some weirdo in a black beret who likes to sit in the dark, listen to dialogue he can't understand, and read subtitles. What next? My father sighs as he contemplates his teal-blue gallstones and the muffled sound they make, so much like the meaningless word the supporting actor mouths before the scene fades to black. All right. Enough of family for a while, anyway. I really don't have a basketball poem. I'm sorry, but I don't. But I've got a baseball poem, which is about the closest to sports that I can get, because I'm a real baseball fanatic. And actually, this is entitled Ars Poetica, but it's not about the art of poetry. It's about baseball. And one person I mention in here, Tito Francona, he used to play for the Cleveland Indians in the late 50s, and he was really, when I was a little kid, the first man I ever fell in love with. I mean, chewing tobacco back then was... Oh, I thought it was so great. Anyway, but so Tito's in this poem, and this is called Ars Poetica. On a hot summer night in Michigan, I dreamt a well-known American poet was reduced to playing right field for the St. Louis Cardinals. Before a game, I saw him on the city's south side, looking famous and bored in his tiny upper flat. The place reminded me of Detroit, like every American city in decay. Actually, the poet wanted to play for Cincinnati, but St. Louis's colors were just as red, so why not? He was having a great season, leading the division with his batting average, even though it was a measly 163. And deep down, he knew that a mediocre player of the 50s, like Tito Francona of the Indians, had a better average, and back then it meant nothing. So the poet with the 163 felt lucky and blessed to be at bat and away from his typewriter. The New Yorker had rejected too many of his poems, so that's why baseball in St. Louis and the embarrassing batting average. Before his turn at bat, he sells popcorn and keeps looking for me in the stands, but I knew that an affair in real life was hopeless. And now it comes to this, the unreality of St. Louis playing Cleveland in the regular season. The poet finally takes his position in the outfield, but only after he strips butt naked. He does calisthenics while waiting for a ball to come his way, push-ups, sit-ups, a concentrated attempt at yoga. He exercises naked as if he's trying to fuck something that isn't there. And once I wanted him like that. In the green hills of Vermont at some vague writer's conference. I wanted him so bad, but he kept missing my signals and planted a solid one right through my roommate instead, a stake in her crazy heart. And all I got from his room were the sounds of Janis Joplin screaming her lungs blue, in the Vermont air, not knowing what the hell to do with it. So it was better to be in this dream and back to baseball, watching the naked slick poet on the playing field and the woman in the stands yelling for a line drive, a sinking ball to short right field, so she could just once see his body falling in the green grass below her feet. All right. Ah, now, onto art. Visual art, not just the art of baseball. I've always been, one of my other obsessions, passions, is the artist Magritte, René Magritte. And I have to say, he's not even my favorite. I mean, he's not even my, I love him, but he does something to me. He rattles some chain in me, and I've written a number of poems based on his pieces, and I'm going to read you one. It's a short one called The Therapeutist After Magritte. The blank man offers no answers, only memory. The evolution of our torsos from bird cages, how the bright idea of heaven grew out of the cavity of our mouths, how gossip had its humble origin in the pitch of our stomach's growl. After every theory, he offers props so recognizable, we don't even bother to look. The sky continues to be blue, the ocean settles into its grayness, the brown earth reconciles its sullen face. Still, he's part of the landscape, half there and half not, like a double exposure torn between the mirror and chair, the white arc of thigh and empty sleeve, his face resembling the cloud that permeates the heart when an intruder stalks it. As Diane mentioned, several years ago, I went to Poland. I always say I went back to Poland for the first time, which is oxymoron, but I really felt like I was coming back, even though I had never been there before. So the number of the poems I'm going to read now are from a new manuscript called Amber Necklace from Gdansk. Any questions or comments, as I said, you know, before, if you want to pipe up? I'm always looking at you to see the hand raised. And this is called The Rain in Bielsko. Bielsko is a town kind of the size of Grand Rapids. It's in southern Poland. A number of my cousins live there. Actually, one of them is quoted at the end of this poem. He's the punk with short red hair, my cousin Pavel. Should say my cousin Maria's son, Pavel. And I mentioned a statue of a mermaid in this poem. In a Polish myth, in their river Vistula, the mermaid lives. And the Polish word for mermaid is Zarina, from the siren. You know, it's S-Y-R-E-N-A. And so I mentioned that mermaid here. The rain in Bielsko. Men working waist deep in the ground, tunneling for not gold or silver, only brown water. Three times we pass her statue, mermaid abandoned in bronze, no sea to embrace. City square designed by a short man from Vienna, as if foreign is better than a clear view of the clouds. Bielsko is whole, shouts the punk with short red hair. The rain gets lost, its shadow Mary's sidewalk. In our travels to Poland, we met a number of relatives. And one of them is a priest, Father Anthony. We spent one very interesting night in his rectory with a toilet that wouldn't flush and a very spacious, you know, place, but very spare, looked like a monk cell. And I couldn't sleep. I just, my daughter slept, my son, my husband slept. I couldn't sleep much. But what Father Tony gave me at dinner was this wonderful book. And it was in Polish, but it was like a coffee table a picture book, a photography book, full color, a landscape photographs. And one in particular of Mazovian willows really struck me. And Mazovia is the part of Poland that Chopin was born in. So I don't know if you've ever heard Chopin's Nocturne, Opus 9. And if you have it, no problem. That's the title of the piece. But there's also a quote from Chopin that begins the poem. And it's, What has happened to my heart? I can hardly remember how they sing at home. Chopin. Mazovian Willow, Chopin's Nocturne, Opus 9. Did the strain of a mazurka split you in two? Don't tell me lightning, wind, harsh betrayal of nature, anything that has logic. As much logic as a Polish composer with a French name who wrote scores of music for just one instrument. Who was in love with a strong woman that adopted a man's name because she liked simplicity. No logic there, old tree, stark willow. You probably gave Frederick his inspiration, one note at a time, drowning out the sky, changing your life from a single vision to a double one, a split trunk resembling a pair of hands in prayer, bruised fingers of the emigre. Your country not even listed on the map. Perhaps it wasn't a mazurka that cut your heart in two, one side listing to the west, the other firmly planted in Mazovia despite itself. Perhaps it was a simple nocturne, the last fading light before night comes and eyes close, music of goodbye, farewell, the knowledge of never going home again, music of exile that almost forgets the language of the earth that holds roots to its heart. I've never been able, so many times I see people, maybe not so often, write poems, draft poems as they're listening to someone do a poetry reading. I mean, I've seen that and I'm thinking, boy, they're so smart. I've never been able to do that. But it was interesting. I went to a creative nonfiction reading once by Gary Gildner, who also went to Poland on a Fulbright and ended up, believe it or not, ended up managing a baseball team, the Warsaw Sparks. And he wrote this wonderful book called The Warsaw Sparks about his experience with managing this team. And it wasn't what he was reading from the book, but it was an instance of a road trip that he told us about. A little intro to a chapter that he was reading. And it was such a poignant moment in the reading. And it wasn't even from the book. It was just some explanation of, this tour bus and when they went to Katowice. And I was just struck by the poignancy of that moment. And it just so happens that a dear friend of mine, who I've made a good acquaintance, better than acquaintance, I should say, in the last few years, is Ava Parma-Stojowska. She is a poet and essayist who also lives in Katowice. And this is called The Awkward Young Girl Approaching You. I mention Częstochowa, which is the shrine, the small town, where the Black Madonna is kept. Jasna Góra, I mentioned, is the name of the monastery. Częstochowa is that town. The awkward young girl approaching you, for Gary Gildner. Who will speak for the dispossessed, those who come from nowhere, whose birthplace cannot be found on any map, whose muted eyes greet us like yesterday's unread newspaper? The man with the raw hand in his crotch making eye contact, the woman with her nervous walk piercing through traffic with her dismantled face, blue left cheek, right eye gone but not closed, empty red socket fixed at the back of your neck. And though you remind yourself they are not you, they are with you everywhere, on the street, on a bus, in the darkest corner of last night's dream. Even traveling to the country of your grandfather, the country he left before being displaced, cannot protect you from their stares. In Katowice, the grayest city in the grayest part of the world, you are not prepared for the awkward young girl approaching you. She is not pretty, and her hair is not clean like America, but she shimmers in her pale yellow dress and dye to match satin pumps. She is trying to be beautiful, and you are not ready for her smile that reminds you of every single thing you've ever lost. and the way her golden feet attempt to walk on Katowice's gray and broken cobblestones stirs a memory that only your dead grandfather could understand. Wildflowers overrunning the garden, cicadas drowning out the factory's nightly lament. So much grace in her graceless yellow feet, so much of the miraculous in her thin silhouette. It's as if the Black Madonna had unlocked herself from her demanding sun, left the gilded frame of Częstochowa and appeared before you, asking to see your passport, evidence that you came from somewhere, that you exist. Dumbfounded, could you prove yourself? Or would you become another outline, another vague face, the landscape conjured up? Well, I want to go back to actually being in Poland. And I was actually able to visit my grandmother's birthplace, not just the little village. It's not even on a map. It's not even on the map in Poland. It's such a small little, you know, you're there and then you're not there. What a phrase, you're there and then you're not there. But here I was in Doi in southern Poland, and it's the foothills of the Tatra Mountains. You look out and you see the foothills of the Tatras. And I saw the birthplace where Ciocia Zosia, which is Grandma Sophie, no, Aunt Sophie, Ciocia's aunt, because they call her aunt. She was my grandmother, but their Ciocia. And Zosia, what a woman. She's the toenail woman. And she was my father's mother. And unfortunately, that hut, and it was built in like 1888, two-room hut, one room for the family and one room for the animals. And they had eight kids. So it was like one room, mother, father, eight kids, and then the animals got the whole room, you know, to themselves. Unfortunately, this hut burned last year, and it was destroyed. And I'm not exactly sure if it was fire or a storm or what, but one of my cousins wrote to my mother and said, at least Linda got to stand in the place where her grandmother was born. So this is about that place. In my grandmother's house, too much magenta in my grandmother's house, magenta on my lips, cheeks, and dress, a foreign color that doesn't belong in this small, whitewashed hut surrounded by earth, rain, and the green hills of Poland. When she was born here over 100 years ago, this color probably wasn't invented yet by the dye merchant who dreamed a battlefield of purplish red fabric and came up with a new fashion craze. No fashion here, only the color of the hard dirt floor as it breathes the air of the icon on the wall, doleful Madonna, her blue heart pierced with seven daggers, all gray and breathless like eyes watching my every American move. Too much magenta for this place where cows and chickens live in the next room, where my great-grandmother froze to death in January of 29, just yards from the front door, falling near the woodpile, falling with no one home to help her back inside. Too much magenta on my lips as they form the obligatory O in sadness, in grief for the woman whose name I didn't even know until that moment. Too much magenta on my cheeks as they are brushed with kisses not once or twice, but three times by my great aunt Anna and her one-armed son who still live there, afraid to move into a modern house for fear they'll die with indoor plumbing and no animals. Too much magenta in my dress that is touched by the rain in spite of my cousin Michael's umbrella, jagged black ripped from a broken spoke. Too much magenta reflecting off the glass frame, holding the sepia wedding picture of my grandmother and grandfather, newly Americanized in Cleveland. No going back to southern Poland, to the hills of Doi, until their granddaughter returns to this house as if she was a sleepwalker and dreams of a world in black and white where everything is sharp and in focus and the clear rain fits quietly in her hand. And from that hut, I went to the graveyard and I went to the cemetery where my relatives were buried, my great-grandparents. And I realized that I've come back and my grandmother didn't even return for the funerals of her mother and father. When she left, she left. She left. And always was faithful in writing and sending money, but never went back. And this is about going back to that cemetery. After the war, purple flowers spilling from the windows. That's the title. In Poland, the land takes over everything, unrelenting in its mission to regenerate after the war. Fields overrun sidewalks, train stations, street corners. Purple flowers spill from the open windows of houses. Queen Anne's lace reigns supreme in parking lots. Even the dead in cemeteries are affected. No neatly trimmed grass here, but waves upon waves of wildflowers. Blue lupine, saffron, black-eyed Susan, chicory. The dead love this wildness growing above their bones. Tock, tock, they whisper in the hush of the wind that scatters the soft gossamer of dandelions into the waiting air. Take over this place that was once lost. Cover it in so much color, even the clouds who've seen everything won't know where death lived for so long. And who can argue with the dead? Not their thin ghosts or unborn progeny. Not their exile who returns after the war, stands bewildered at their graves, hip deep in blue-eyed grass, trying to decipher names that already belong to the earth. This next piece, I know Mark Sheehan knows because I've sent this to him and he's read it. And it's also from the travel to Poland. And we spent a day in Auschwitz. And I couldn't go on to Birkenau. Auschwitz was enough. And this is partly about that day. Unfortunately, everything is true in this. It's a prose poem, and I wish it wasn't. I have in the beginning of this piece, I talk about my actual name, which is Niemiec. It's now been changed to Nemec, my maiden name, but my real maiden name is Niemiec, which is Polish for German. Believe it or not. Okay. Mengele's butterflies. Now, of course, Mengele is the infamous, talk about the ultimate doctor death. Mengele's butterflies. On the red-eye overnight Lufthansa flight, nonstop from Chicago to Frankfurt, I am surrounded by the clip staccato of German, and I am reminded of my name, my real maiden name, Niemiec, which is Polish for German, Linda Niemiec, Linda Deutsch, Linda German. A guy from Albany, New York once told me the mythical origins of my name. When the mainly Slavic tribes were confronted for the first time by Germanic tribes, they, of course, couldn't understand what was being said. The Germans tried speaking louder and wildly gesticulating. They thought that this would get their ideas across. The Slavs just thought the Germans were mad or maybe deaf and couldn't hear a thing without shouting. So Niemiec has its roots in the word mute for the Slavic languages. At least that's what the guy in Albany told me. And maybe that's why Hitler and Stalin ultimately never hit it off. Despite that bankrupt non-aggression pact they signed in 1939, the pact that signed the beginning of the end for Poland and, in a larger sense, for Germany and Russia, too. I think Hitler always suspected Stalin of being a Jew. As a matter of fact, he even had his official state photographer go to Moscow before Hitler ever met Stalin and take close-up photos of Stalin's earlobes to see if they were connected, i.e. Aryan, or disconnected and separate, i.e. Jewish, according to the current racial theories espoused by the Nazis. The photographer did his job, with complete discretion, of course, and Hitler pronounced Stalin's earlobes connected and Aryan. So Slavic ears were spared, but not Slavic eyes. The notorious angel of death at Auschwitz, Dr. Josef Mengele, had a fascination for Jewish and Slavic eyes, along with his obsession for twins. Blue and brown were beautiful, but too commonplace. What really excited him was the rare hazel and even the rare green. On the wall of his office at Auschwitz were meticulous rows of colors that rivaled gorgeous butterflies. Their colors an array of variations of blue, brown, green, violet, black. Their colors created from the preserved irises of his victims. Eyes of the Jew from Warsaw, the Pole from Tarnow, the Gypsy from Budapest, the homosexual from Prague. And I think of my mother's mother with her jet black hair and olive skin, looking not Slavic or Germanic, but different, as if Hitler, with his penchant for earlobes, could uncover the secret of what it is that sets us apart from one another.